This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is with me. I am Paula, and we are both with Melanie Mitchell. We're at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where all kinds of interesting things are done, often using computers. That embedded question was...
Is it or is it not the case? Yeah.
It seemed that you were asking sort of... What are computers doing for science these days? And, you know, as you mentioned, computers are letting us model extremely complicated systems that we're never able to model before. For instance, the weather. One of the things that people do here and a lot of other places is use these very, very fast parallel computers to model climate change, to try and do weather prediction. I mentioned before von Neumann, who was one of the people who invented computers. One of his primary applications that he saw for computers was doing weather prediction, something that obviously they couldn't do very well before the advent of computers. He was at Princeton at the time, at the Institute for Advanced Study, and at Princeton, they felt that weather prediction was simply not science.
Beneath them.
Beneath them. So he had to come to Los Alamos to work on that, building computers to do that kind of thing.
That's very interesting. Well, you talk about how computers, those early guys, at least as interested in as they were in the science and the mechanical stuff, that they cared about these big complicated things like weather and brains and psychology and the big things that are tough to get your hands around, which takes us back to science, yes?
Right. One of the things that's kind of gotten lost in the computer revolution is the original impetus. One of the original impetuses for this whole thing was to try and understand biological systems. People like von Neumann, Norbert Wiener, Alan Turing, these were all pioneers of computers and areas that used to be called cybernetics. They were all interested in biology. They wanted to understand how it was that the brain worked, and they saw computers as a kind of model for the brain. Or they wanted to understand how it was that biological systems or organisms could reproduce themselves. So von Neumann, it was actually stated by a lot of biologists that one of the main differences between machines and living systems was that living systems could reproduce themselves and machines couldn't. So one of the first things von Neumann did on computers was show that, in fact, computers could reproduce themselves. And that just shot down that argument. And one of the things that computers have been doing ever since is proving wrong every assertion that's made about what the differences are between machines and living things, sort of one by one. And so the list is getting smaller and smaller. And so the question is, what's left for living things? And there's a whole field of science now called artificial life, which is basically trying to make computers more lifelike and have us also understand living systems as more like machines.
You say artificial life, and it raises, in the context you're talking about, the notion of artificial intelligence. And there was, from the outside, it seems like there was sort of a hiccup in the development of this when...
In development of what?
The application of computers to human systems. Particularly, again, from the outside, it centered at MIT, where we tried to very quickly make computers behave as intelligent entities, that is, artificial intelligence, as opposed to the artificial life. And there was a great deal of sound and fury in the 50s and 60s about machines that were going to be smarter than we were.
That's right.
And then it got very quiet for a while.
Yeah.
And now there's a more diffuse discussion that includes, I think, still talk of artificial life, though I think a modified form of it. And then what you just mentioned, the artificial intelligence.
You said the other way back.
And what you mentioned, the artificial life piece of this. And it seems like there is more humility in this and probably better science.
That's right. There's a famous dictum, I think, was said by Marvin Minsky, who started the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, that he said, in artificial intelligence, we learned that hard things are easy and easy things are hard. Mm-hmm. Things like doing high-level symbolic calculus, mathematics on a computer, we can do that very easily. We have lots of programs that can do that now. Playing chess at the level of grandmaster, that's been accomplished. In fact, a chess program, a computer program, is now world champion, has beat the world champion in chess. Things like that that people thought were the hardest things to do turned out to be not so hard. The hardest things for computers are the easiest things for us, things like recognizing a face or walking around a room without bumping into things. Those things nobody knows how to do on computers even now.
Go back to this chess thing, if you would, please, just for a minute. You talk in, again, I am just amazed that you have written a book called An Introduction to Genetic Algorithms that is readable by somebody like me. But you open up a whole world. You're really associated. Your name is associated with the development of genetic algorithms, and you've worked with John Holland, who pretty much set the stage for a lot of the predicates for genetic algorithms and thinking in an evolutionary sense about how you can apply evolutionary thinking to computers. You say in this remarkable book that solving the grandmaster problem was easy. It's all of the things around solving the grandmaster problem that really aren't solving the problem. It's the how you think about it, that setting a computer off to win the game is quite different from the way that humans work.
That's right. Well, I should first say that I actually came to genetic algorithms fairly late in the game. That was quite a lot of work done before I even heard of the field. But I do find it very interesting that these chess programs do so well when they do what they do so differently than what people do. The chess programs use what we call brute force. They look at every possibility. You know, if you and I are playing chess against each other, and you make a move. And then I think, oh, if I move this piece here, then you're going to move this piece here, then I'm going to move this piece here. And I can usually think about maybe three, maybe four steps ahead if I'm lucky. Well, these computer programs can think maybe 10 or 12 or 14 steps ahead, which actually is a lot more.
When you say think, you mean calculate.
Yeah.
In this context,
I'm using this word loosely.
Just want to be sure.
Yeah. They can do this immense amount of what we would call look ahead in this, playing this game. And that seems to be the thing that allows them to do so well. Humans can't do that at all. They can just do a very small amount of it. But what humans can do is they can recognize patterns. They can look at a chessboard and say, oh, here's the kind of situation where I should really sacrifice my bishop. Because I've seen this, you know, especially if you're an experienced chess player, you say, I've seen this hundreds of times before. This is this kind of chess situation. And you just recognize the board in a certain pattern, as a certain kind of pattern. Computers can't do that. They can't recognize patterns very well. And so they have to do all this brute force. So one of the things that I and a number of other people are trying to do in our work is trying to get computers to be able to recognize patterns more. Because recognizing patterns is really what I believe general intelligence is about.
Hmm.
The chess computers can play chess, but they can't do anything else. Whereas humans can play chess not as well as the chess computers, but they can do a lot of other things like recognize people or, you know, my little boy, who's less than a year old, can already recognize a dog, both in real life and in a book.
Mm-hmm.
I challenge anybody to get a computer to do that in general.
General intelligence, that's a fascinating concept. That's what humans do, and we've not been able to train our machines to do?
That's right. Machines can do some very specific things. You may have heard of expert systems, which can do things like diagnose diseases better than some doctors. They can do a lot of very impressive things. They have expert systems that can figure out where to find, explore for oil in some kind of, do some kind of geological reasoning. They can do all kinds of very specialized things, but they can't do general thinking the way we can. They're specialists. They're not generalists.
This is Melanie Mitchell. We're going to be back with her in Los Alamos, New Mexico in just a moment. Please be with us when we return, Bill Russell and I, to the Paula Gordon Show.